Brought to you by the Small Business Payments Alliance. According to a new survey, an overwhelming majority of small business owners oppose additional government regulations on the electronic payment system, as called for in the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. Don't let Durbin-Marshall pile new mandates on Main Street small businesses. Learn more at smallbusinesspaymentsalliance.com.
After months of delay, this week House Speaker Mike Johnson advanced his much-awaited version of the Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan foreign aid package. Standing between that legislation and the House floor, two very powerful committees. First, the House Appropriations Committee, which controls about a third of federal spending. And second, the Rules Committee, which controls access to the House floor, and which has become a problem for GOP leaders in this Congress. Johnson needed to pick the lock on both of these committees. And there is one member of Congress who has chaired them both, not just in the past year, but in the past month. Oklahoma Republican Tom Cole. Cole, who was elected in 2002, is known for being close to every GOP leader since the era of John Boehner. In press shorthand, he's usually described as an institutionalist. And since the Tea Party era, he's also been known for butting heads with his more rambunctious colleagues on the far right. Cole is also a member of the Chickasaw Nation, a trained historian, and literally a devotee of Washington's smoke-filled back rooms.
I'm a big believer in open humidors and open bars because they bring people together. Over a cigar, people talk about their work. Even their questions are interesting. Their observations are interesting.
Earlier this month, Cole left the powerful chairmanship of the Rules Committee, where he'd been the ranking Republican since 2019, and ascended to the even more powerful chairmanship of the Appropriations Committee. I caught up with him on Thursday afternoon during one of those days on the Hill where everything seems in flux. Johnson and top Republicans were scrambling to move the foreign aid package, and Cole was at the center of that effort.
That's why, like, I support, obviously, what we're doing on this foreign policy thing. Somebody asked me, would you sign a discharge petition? Never. It's not what anybody on rules, let alone a rules chairman, should do. I wouldn't do it now.
He spent the morning in his new role as chairman of appropriations, testifying on behalf of the bill in front of his former colleagues on the Rules Committee, where three Republicans were rebelling against the aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. We sat down after that with the fate of the legislation still very unclear. We got deep into the weeds of why the Rules Committee has been such a trouble spot for recent GOP speakers. We discussed Johnson's tenure so far and whether Cole thinks he can hang on as members threaten to oust him. Cole also previewed how he'll run the Appropriations Committee, including how he'll handle the controversial earmarks process. And I had Cole answer some prying questions from some of his favorite historians on the subject of Donald Trump. I'm Ryan Lizza, and this is Playbook Deep Dive. You just came from Rules Committee, where you were the chairman, and now you were there as a witness testifying on behalf of the three pieces of legislation on the foreign supplemental. So a good day to do this interview as you sort of captures your transition. Tell us what you learned in the Rules Committee today in terms of the chances of you all successfully passing
I think the chances are very, very high. I mean, there's clearly, and I've always believed that, there's certainly some divisions or interesting divisions within both parties. There's clearly some Democratic division over aid to Israel, should it be conditioned, all that sort of thing. But a majority of the Democratic Party certainly favors supporting Israel, particularly at this particular moment. That's nearly unanimous on our side of the aisle. So check, that one's pretty easy.
And that's not going to lose votes. You think that'll lose Republican votes just out of?
I really don't. Well, actually, if the rule comes down the way we expect, which is separate votes, the speaker's actually done everybody here a favor. I mean, if we just took up the Senate bill as is, people that didn't want to support Israel, but did want to support Ukraine, which is very common on the Democratic side, would have a tough choice. What do I do? Do I vote to help Ukraine and approve Israel when I've got deep concerns about the weapons and how they're being used and what's happening in Gaza? And by the same token, on our side, pretty much unanimous support for Israel, but obviously significant dissent on Ukraine. So I've always thought there's a very substantial number of votes for Ukraine. I think it's stronger within Republican ranks than is commonly believed. You can look at the letters that have been coming out when you've got people like Mike McCall, the chair of foreign relations, Mike Turner, the chair of intelligence, Mike Rogers, the chair of House Armed Services Committee. Those are our leading thinkers on foreign policy and defense policy. They're all lined up to support this. They'll be able to deliver substantial majorities of their committees. Now, of course, the big Democratic complaint is that it's taken too long and this is critical. And, you know, why didn't we just bring the Senate bill? I always point out, well, you know, we did send them a bipartisan TikTok bill that nobody seemed to be able to work on and a bipartisan tax package that nobody's worked on. And we've had H.R. 2 sitting over there since last year. We're not the only people that take time. This is left over from McCarthy's ascension, but we've got provisions in the rules that allow one or two people to, literally one, to, force a motion to vacate. And we have a narrow enough majority that if the Democrats are united in supporting that, as they were in Speaker McCarthy's case, then a very few Republicans can disrupt everything.
All right, we got a lot to unpack there.
Yeah, sorry.
First, I've got a few just off the top of my head quickly. Is the corollary to what you said about your leading thinkers on the Republican side being in favor of these bills that the folks on the Republican side who oppose it are not necessarily the leading thinkers on foreign policy?
Well, Gates
and MTG, are you saying that?
I'm not into – look, you're allowed to advocate for the things you believe in.
Yeah.
These are very capable advocates. And so I'm not – again, I haven't been critical of anybody's position. It's a tough thing. And I think all of us are very critical about, you know, the manner in which – President Biden has handled this. I mean, we all think that the debacle in Afghanistan is one of the things that encouraged Putin in the invasion. We all think it was a mistake if you were going to try to deter that you didn't start sending weapons earlier. Frankly, we all
think. As the buildup was happening?
Yeah. And yeah. I think a considerable number of us still think it's not hard to tell the good guys from the bad guys in this situation. It's not Ukraine that invaded Russia. It's been a very brutal invasion. It's dangerous in that we know if Putin succeeds here, it probably wouldn't be NATO next, but it probably certainly be Georgia or Moldova, countries outside of the alliance that don't have Article 5 protection. And, you know, you can look at the Baltics, they really could be overrun in a very short period of time. Yeah. That would involve us. Those are NATO countries, and we'd have an Article 5 responsibility. So, again, there's disagreement over this, but the idea that helping Ukraine is in America's interest, I think, is widely held. And I think so far it's been interesting. I don't think when Vladimir Putin started his invasion, he thought he was going to push Finland and Sweden into NATO. That's
right.
A big strategic defeat. That's right. I don't think he ever counted on 300,000 plus Russian casualties. I'm sure he didn't count on a 2 to 3 year war. So I think they've taken considerable, damage over this really bad decision. But doesn't change the fact they're still a larger country. They still are a very tough adversary. They're an exceptionally resilient people. They've proven that throughout their history. And honestly, they're still, as far as we can tell, in a totalitarian state, there's still significant public support for this. This isn't like Afghanistan near the end and the Russian period. So, lot of us think it's just the right thing to do in America's interest. Others have a disagreement. That's fine. That's what Congress is about.
Let me ask you a couple of quick process questions on some of the things you mentioned before. One, on the motion to vacate, which McCarthy reduced to one member, Do you think that that should be raised?
And I do.
Is leadership considering that right now?
You'd have to ask them that. Believe me, it's certainly being widely.
You talk to them pretty frequently.
Yeah, well, it's being widely being widely discussed, but not so much as I think a lot of members are frustrated with this. And frankly, I think it's on both sides of the aisle.
Sure.
I mean, they see the turmoil. I think Democrats kind of enjoyed it in McCarthy's case because they weren't particularly fond of him. He was our most effective political player, largest fundraiser, best candidate recruiter, best strategist. So I get why they wanted to take our Tom Brady off the field. But now they've seen, geez, this is getting out of hand. And do we really want, although they did this to McCarthy, McCarthy got taken out for taking something Democrats wanted to take to the floor. He kept the government open on a Saturday, and he was fired on a Tuesday.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of Democrats.
Well, presumably Republicans wanted to keep the government open, too.
Well, obviously, most of us did, but it wasn't all of us. There was 125 or 30. We were pretty much a substantial majority, but not everybody. And so, and the Democrats knew that McCarthy was running a political risk when he did that. We certainly had, I had a number of, oh, don't worry, Tom, if he does it, we've got your back. Well, we saw how reliable that was. They didn't. And, again, I never complain about it because had the tables been reversed, I probably wouldn't vote to keep Nancy Pelosi as speaker. So I'm not, you just have to recognize politics, but, McCarthy fell on his sword trying to do the right thing and keep the government open and push us toward an agreement, which he did. And
what do you think the right number is for the motion to vacate?
I haven't gotten down to ever think of it, but substantial.
Double digits?
Well, yes. Frankly, I think you should have a majority of your own caucus that wants to do this.
Yeah.
If it's a Republican speaker, we should never put ourselves – I mean, we had eight people that put ourselves at the mercy of the Democratic minority leader.
Yeah.
And there wasn't any mercy in that case. And quite frankly, they had no alternative candidate. They had no exit strategy. It was just, I'm mad and I have the ability to do it. Well, every caucus can have a few of those members. You should never be in such a weak position, structurally, process-wise, rules-wise, that a group that small can do something as significant as bring down a speaker.
One of the consequences of that, process-wise, rules-wise, was that the Rules Committee that you chaired until very recently was stacked with some of the more, exotic members, or members that don't always do the will of leadership.
Well,
this Rules Committee is known as the Speaker's Committee.
Now, I think this is very different because, frankly, none of those members were involved in any effort to overturn the Speaker.
Right. But they were sort of a few clicks to the left. But
the reality is, I mean, this was McCarthy's idea, is if I'm going to have a problem, I want to see it in Rules Committee, not on the floor.
Got it.
So, and we've never had a problem in passing out of rule. I mean, it's one of these
common
things.
You didn't lose any in committee.
People, we never lost in committee.
But you lost, but
on the floor.
Six since June, I think.
Seven.
Seven from June to now.
No, from January, not since June, from January of last year.
Okay, so you lost seven from January to now on the floor.
Yeah, January of last year. Yeah, absolutely. That's
a conference problem, not a rules committee problem, because we didn't lose them. And we're not responsible once it goes out the door.
Our deal is to produce the rule that our leadership asks us to produce.
Sure, but that doesn't include all the rules that you didn't even put forward in the committee because you didn't.
No, that's not true.
No.
I mean, there's no rule that we were ever seriously considered that we couldn't get out of committee.
Now, you're not the chairman anymore, but the rule, what about today? Do you think that the rule will require Democratic votes?
It may well. It may well. And by the way, we have done that before in other
while you were chairman? Not while you were chairman.
No, I actually did it before when people were in a normal deal. you can negotiate ahead of times with the Democrats.
So has that been done
happened,
here?
But not very, very not very frequent, but it's not unknown.
Are you ever disappointed that your tenure as chairman of the Rules Committee, this storied, powerful committee in American history, overlapped with this period when you had when it was not quite the Speaker's Committee that it had been in years past.
We're just going to pass the same. It was the Speaker's Committee. Because what did it not get out that the Speaker asked it to get out, whether it was McCarthy or Johnson? It did every time. So the problem is a conference problem on the floor of the House.
Not committee.
It's not the committee. And that's often lost in people. It's a, you know, again, we never failed to do that. So the committee, again, and it functioned the way McCarthy wanted it to. The number of times we fixed problems in there that individual members have that represented larger groups of problems is one of those things you don't see because you don't see the save. You only see the final product that then moves through the committee, and that happened quite a bit. I don't regret the time being there in the least. I mean, it's a wonderful committee. It's fantastic staff. Jim McGovern and I have been good friends. We spent a dozen years on that committee together, working up the dais. It was just always his ambition to chair it. It was never mine. I had five speakers put me on that committee. I never asked one time to go on rules. As a matter of fact, the last time when I was put on here with becoming first the ranking member and then the chair, I was shocked when McCarthy called me over.
Yeah.
And I just started laughing. I said, "Leader, I love you, but ain't no way I'm doing this. I'm not giving up, ranking member spot on the largest, domestic spending and a senior position on defense, even in a minority, to go do rules." And he said, no, you can keep approach. I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, Tom, it's a lot of extra hours and all that, but I said, I want to think about it overnight." And I came back the next morning and I said, "I'll do it." Here's the thing you need to know. Number one, you can have it back whenever you want it. This is not something I've asked for. You want it back. You need to move it somebody. You don't even have to ask me. Number two, if I ever have to choose, if you get some complaint from somebody that, "Oh, Tom's got, two positions. He's got both a ranking member and a ranking member in a full committee, a ranking member on a subcommittee, or, if things ever worked out, he's got a chairmanship here and a subcommittee," then I'm choosing a probes. Just you need to understand that. That's my career path. It's not here. So, in that sense, I was an unusual choice. Forget anybody else because it was, never something I asked to do or wanted to do, something he thought would be useful to him and the conference for me to do. And I told Johnson, I'm not sure that he realized all these were direct appointments, that they were not steering committee. And I told him, we met again, we're good friends. I nominated him to be vice chair of the conference. And I said, "Now, Speaker, you can make any change on this committee you want, including me right now." And he said, "Really? I would never do that." And I said, "No, it'd be okay. I mean, these are, you had that conversation
when he took over as Speaker."
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I would have that with any speaker. I mean, I wouldn't take that personal. I mean, they need to have who they want there.
Yeah.
And again, I knew where I was at it, and it was not there. I mean, I was already busy running to try and succeed my good friend Chair Granger because she'd made it clear she wasn't going to run again and she wasn't going to ask for an extension. So, we were already talking to steering committee people and doing that. So I've ended up where I always hoped to, have the privilege of being. But I certainly don't regret my time on rules. I mean, I served with great members. It was an interesting committee and met great staff. I think Kelly Dixon is one of the great institutional players in this place. Staff's always undervalued. Members usually think they're more important than they are.
Is there a moment when the tradition of not voting against a rule, when the sort of dam broke and you saw that, okay, this is going to be a thing going forward? This is going to be
the first time it happens, this is not the way it's supposed to work. And look, I don't, the rule is a tool for the majority, any majority, either side, to shape the legislation in a way that it thinks maximizes its chance to pass. That's what the rule's for. What happened here is people decided they would start using it as a weapon against others. And they thought they could be the only ones. Well, the minute somebody starts to do it, other people, if you get to do it, I get to do it. So
what enforced that previously that doesn't work anymore?
I think people aren't willing to play for the norms. Go back to the very beginning Why would 21 people think that they should be decide that 86% of their conference aren't going to exist? So this is not something that starts in rules or whatever. This is something that's been with us for a while.
Is it generational? Is it ideological?
Well, it's, back to Boehner. People use this as a weapon against Boehner. They use it as a weapon against Ryan or the threat of it.
Sure.
We just finally saw the dam break. And part of this is, I think, too, these are comparatively newer members in many cases, not always, that use it, but it's just breaking the norms. And I would argue it's a lack of respect for the institution and the wisdom of the institution. I mean, these things have evolved over not decades, but centuries. I mean, this is a 234-year-old institution. Nobody had lost a rule in 20 years, a majority of either side. And does anybody think the people that have used it, people that have used it, are people that, frankly, aren't going to likely ever be elected to leadership?
Yeah.
So it's, you got to grow up and learn what appropriate thing.
I want to challenge that a little bit because you endorsed Jim Jordan for speaker.
Of course I did.
And Jordan, like a lot of members when they first came in, he was on the wing of the party that was willing to violate some of these norms and take on some of the rules. And, by last year, he's, a card-carrying member of the establishment being endorsed by Tom Cole.
Well, I'm happy to endorse him. Look, he earned
You see the MTGs in the Gateses of the world taking that path?
John Boehner and I didn't agree. You think I voted for John Boehner the first time that he was running for speaker in conference when he had, made my life miserable at the NRCC and endorsed Pete Sessions against me? No, but I would have never dreamed of going to the floor and voting against it once the conference had made its decision.
Yeah.
And that's just the way the game is played. You have
Jordan,
an opportunity.
You endorsed him, though. I mean,
pardon?
You gave a nominating speech for Jim.
Yeah, Boehner. I'm chairman of the Rules Committee. He was our nominating. He was our candidate for speaker.
I'm only bringing it up just to show that some of the most out there right wing guys, move into the establishment over time.
Again, I think Jim Jordan has been a very effective chairman of Judiciary. If you don't think he has some bipartisan skills, he's up there with Nadler arguing for their version of FISA.
Yeah.
He certainly didn't participate in the overthrow of any speaker. I don't know that he's ever voted against a rule. He may have. I haven't followed his career all that way, but he certainly had in any recent years. And he's been a good team player. And, when he's been given responsible positions, first at Oversight and Judiciary, I would argue he's occupied them responsibly and he's played within the rules. And he was the nominee of my party. He won the vote. So why would I not support the nominee of my party, particularly if you're on the Rules Committee? For God's sake, you're going to start breaking the traditions and the rules. That's why, I support, obviously, what we're doing on this foreign policy thing. Somebody asked me, would you sign a discharge petition? Never. It's not what anybody on rules, let alone a rules chairman, should do. I wouldn't do it now. I don't, I'm not in the business of taking away authority from the majority that I'm part of and handing it over to the minority for any reason at any time. You're not supposed to do that.
On the speaker battle from last year, your name was floated quite a bit during those weeks when they were trying to pick a new
speaker. Shows you how desperate the situation was. Never going to happen.
You never considered it at all?
Nope.
Not even a moment? There's no House of Cards moment where you thought, I could be running this place?
No. Well, anybody that wanted to be running this place should, probably have had a psychiatric examination at the moment. But no, I mean, I know where I want to go and I know what I want to do. And speaker is not it.
Brought to you by the Small Business Payments Alliance. According to a new survey, an overwhelming majority of small business owners oppose additional government regulations on the electronic payment system, as called for in the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. Don't let Durbin-Marshall pile new mandates on Main Street small businesses. Learn more at smallbusinesspaymentsalliance.com.
That's a good segue to talk about being chairman of the Appropriations Committee, which I think is where you wanted to be, right?
Absolutely.
Let's talk about some of the issues that you're going to have to grapple with on this committee. First is, let's talk about earmarks.
Mm-hmm.
there's two sides of this debate historically. One is that earmarks are sort of the lubricant that helps legislation get through Congress, that in a positive way. It allows a little bit of horse trading. The flip side is it's gotten out of hand at certain points, and it's led to corruption.
And people have gone to jail. I think that's a pretty good indication that there needed to be some guardrails put on.
So what's your view of earmarks?
Well, first of all, I look on them less as something to get legislation passed and more as something where members can tangibly do something they think is important in their district usually. And I think they're an appropriate tool. There's a lot of misunderstanding of them. They don't add to the deficit because we set the top line before we ever, so we know what we're spending up to. Now, I'm not a big fan of using them as either, carrots or sticks. Nobody should vote yes on a bill they would otherwise oppose because they got a bridge.
But as a student of history, don't you think earmarks have sort of helped unlock some significant legislation in history that's been important?
If you can solve a problem for a member and it's legitimate, sure. But if it's, this would help me get there, you can save billions by spending millions sometimes. People actually vote to cut spending to get an earmark sometime because that particular problem is more important to them. So it's how you use the tool. I think we've set up some really good guidelines, Democrats and Republicans alike. I think because we went a decade without them, people are being very careful about minding their P's and Q's, and we've put more transparency on it. You can't airdrop earmarks into conference committees anymore. You got to publish them. You guys are going to look at them. You got to sign statements that you don't have any financial connections there, and we take that seriously. The organizations are vetted a lot more than they ever were before. We don't send them to private entities anymore. So, again, there's a lot of major reforms, but they're still a useful tool. I think they're an appropriate thing to do. And, I don't have any problem with members being able to do something that matters in their district as long as it's done within the rules. And hopefully it's done in ways that, don't bring discredit to the institution in some way.
I want to talk about one of the unique aspects of your website, which is you're always posting what you're reading. And you recommend, you don't always recommend the books, but often you recommend what you're reading. And I want to talk about some of your recent books. I think the most recent one on there is Garrett Graff's book, UFO.
Yeah.
And so I was talking to Garrett today and asked him, what's a good question for Cole, who's a historian, a student of history. And so this section of the conversation, I'm going to have some questions from the authors of the books that you've been recommending. And some of them are tough. This one isn't that hard, though. So one of Garrett's clear arguments in that book is that the government is definitely covering up what it knows, but he assumes probably what it knows isn't that interesting. But why do you think the government covers up what it knows about UFOs?
Because I think in this case, and Garrett actually makes this point, it's because we don't know very much and we don't want people to realize we know that little. The reality is we've spent decades looking at this. We don't know much more than we knew. Now, we have a much more sophisticated understanding of the universe, the size, the scope, the likelihood that there is intelligent life someplace in an area this vast that has gone on this many billions of years. I mean, it's almost unimaginable. And obviously, we've earned it. You talk to people, there's certainly some interesting accounts of things, but the bottom line is we still haven't cracked the mystery. And we can't tell people that we can explain every kind of aerial phenomenon that they see. That in and of itself is pretty valuable. But again, it's really not a study of UFOs. To be fair, it's a study of the studies of UFOs and the effort of the government to, beginning really in the 40s, when you start seeing these Foo Fighters in World War II, and pretty quickly after that, you're into all these sightings. What is this? And we couldn't tell Americans with any certainty in 1947, and we can't tell them with much certainty in 2024 what they are. But anyway, I thought the book showed both the benefits and the limitations of what government can do in answering a very, challenging question. But it's, it's not a moral question. It's not a metaphysical question. It's not a values question. It's a, what the hell are these things? We're getting a lot of reports and we still haven't been able to define them. And they also, to me, show how suspicious people are. They always think the government knows something that it probably doesn't know and might not even be capable of knowing. But everybody wants to think there's always some big secret. There's always some vast conspiracy. I can tell you as an old historian, coincidence is a lot more common in history than conspiracy.
The other book you recommended recently is Jeffrey Frank's The Trials of Harry S. Truman, which I think you called the single best account of the Truman administration.
In my view, and that includes even the McCollum biography, because it's a full biography. There's a difference. There's a dense focused on eight, really consequential years, and a guy that probably, nobody would have ever thought of as presidential if he hadn't been picked out of a hat almost at just the right moment by FDR. And so, but I thought it was a great book. And so, Jeffrey's, wonderfully researched.
All right. So Jeffrey, who happens to be my former editor, an old friend of mine,
Tell him I've got his Dick and Ike book, too. It's on my shelf. It's coming up.
Oh, he'll appreciate that. That's a good one. His question is about the limits and restraints on presidential power. And he brought up the example of when Truman tried to seize the steel mills, and the Supreme Court came back and said, no, you can't do that, and wrote that the purpose of the Constitution was not to grant power, but to keep it from getting out of hand. You know that history.
Yeah.
And Jeff wondered, how do you react to Trump's threat to assumed dictatorial powers, even for a day, if he gets elected?
Well, I think that's hyperbole. First of all, you have to look at the way Trump speaks. And I don't see anything he said in that case as much different than what Joe Biden did on his first day. He decided we're going to stop the Keystone Pipeline. He had the ability to do it because it crosses an international border. He wouldn't have been able to do something like it if it was running from Cushing to Houston inside the United States. But he had that power. He reversed a lot of powers by executive order that Trump had assumed. He didn't talk to us about it. He didn't come talk to Congress about it. I mean, clearly his campaign or his transition had developed some sort of list. These are the things we're going to do. I think that's all Trump's talking about. I don't see this as dictatorial power on day one. I see it as an aggressive use of what's already been established as executive authority, which is a member of Congress. I don't like a lot of times. Again, I don't see it as any different than presidents of both parties have done. And that, President Obama did. I got a phone. I got a pen. I mean, come on. These guys are all pushed the limits, but I still think the constitutional framework is a lot stronger and tougher. And the commitment to constitutional norms by the American people is a lot deeper than most people seem to think.
This is a similar question from Michael Beschloss, who wrote Presidents of War, which you recommended a while back. And he talks about how, the message of that book is that the Constitution gives any president potentially enormous unchecked power. And he wonders that as a lover of democracy, this is his question, as a lover of democracy who knows history, do you feel any trepidation about putting this enormous power in the hands of Donald Trump?
No more than I would any other individual. Again, I think, remember the scene, again, the Lincoln book that's, Lincoln movie that's based on Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, where he rises up and he wants something done, the 13th Amendment, something I think we all agree with now. And he's talking to a group of lobbyists and advisors or whatever, and he goes, I'm the president of the United States, cloaked in enormous power. This will get done. So there is enormous power there. But there are also really strong checks and balances, and there's also a very strong, tradition in American history of federalism. And I am not, as worried as his political opponents are. Now, I think what people do worry about with Trump is, I will tell you this, having dealt with him over a term, Not directly, not in any, and look, I'm not one of these guys that gets on the phone every day to try to call the president to tell him what to do. I mean, I usually, one of my rules in politics is never give unsolicited advice. It never turns out well. So I don't call presidents telling them things, but I've seen this one close enough up, that if he tells you he's going to try and do something, he's going to try and do it. He will push to the limits of his authority. Now, he's transactional and he's practical, and he knows there are limits to his authority. So, no, I'm not – don't put me in that group that says I think democracy is at risk if the guy is president for 4 years. The judgments may be right or wrong, and that's fair game. But I think the constitutional order in the country is very, very strong.
You also had Tim Snyder's On Tyranny on your list. That book has become almost a Bible to people on the left mm-hmm. who are deeply concerned about Trump. Is there anything?
Well, people were deeply concerned about FDR, and a lot of people.
No, fair. That's why I'm asking you, because you study this stuff and you study some of the same works.
And
some of these same writers take very different lessons from this history than you do. That's why I'm asking you.
But,
so is there's anything from that book or this general kind of collection?
Power can be abused. It's not so much from that, but let's just talk about who's abused power in American history. Look, I'm Chickasaw Indian. My great-grandfather got moved 800 miles by a Democratic president named Andrew Jackson. So did thousands of my people. And so that was
and Trump put his portrait in the Oval Office.
I know. I was not happy about it and let him know. But
how did he react?
I think somebody just told him he was an anti-establishment president. By the way, Democrats had Jackson, what was it?
Jefferson-Jackson dinner.
Yeah, or Jefferson-Jackson. So slave owner and two slave owners and an Indian guy. And they thought that was really a good thing, or an anti-Indian president, two anti-Indian presidents, to be fair. So that's an enormous abuse of power. FDR, interning 120,000 Japanese was something certainly George Bush never thought about doing with Muslims or something. Quite the opposite. I mean, he's going to a mosque, and we need to not overreact. So,
although I got to point out that Trump tried to institute a Muslim ban.
Well, look at what he did, what he said, in which countries, and it's much different than described. So, I don't want to get in here defending or whatever, but all I'm saying is, the lesson is this idea that somehow this has not happened in American history before, that we have not had that far worse abuses. I mean, Indian removal is a far worse abuse than anything Donald Trump ever did or contemplated doing, in my view. I
think all these historians would agree with you there.
120,000 American citizens, for the most part, put in not concentration camp, but interned forcibly out of their home, losing their property. Those are people, in both cases, that Democrats historically have really celebrated. They think these are really wonderful people. Power abuse isn't the province of any one party. And right now, it's used as a weapon, politically, and that's unfortunate. We want to talk about lessons of history, that's fine. But I view this as serious. It's worth talking about. But do I think the constitutional order is in that kind of danger? No, I don't. I worry right now more about the polarization inside the country than I do about the abuses of any particular politician.
The last question, we have a tradition on this show where the last question I ask is actually something proposed by our previous guest who didn't know.
I wish I just should have known
was. We should have told you, but this will be an interesting one because he of course didn't know that you were going to be our guest. But this question comes from Michael Cohen.
Ah.
Yes, that Michael Cohen. And then I want you, once you answer this, you can come up with a question for our next guest. And you don't know who it's going to be.
Yeah, and I don't know that I have a particularly good question. I wish I'd have known something about this. We should have done more research.
And we could always take a minute, but here's Michael Cohen's question. And, I think, I'll just ask it. Why do you think that Merrick Garland failed to move the January 6th and other cases more expeditiously so as to ensure that the case would not interfere with the unwritten rule of the DOJ about not having anything active 90 days before an election.
I wouldn't suggest a conspiracy. I don't know. Again, I actually never dealt with it directly, but I was pretty heavily involved in the Oklahoma City bombing. He did the prosecution.
Oh, so you know him from that?
I wouldn't say I know him, but obviously I was following it pretty closely. I was literally the guy appointed by Frank Keating to be liaison with the federal government. Hmm. Now, I wasn't dealing with justice matters. We were dealing with Reconstruction. Obviously, we interacted with the FBI a lot and, as they were looking early on, but, got results. We knew who it was pretty quickly. They did a good, Highway Patrol guy ends up picking the guy up on the way out. I mean, it's just amazing. But, I would say this, I think one of the reasons why I think the second impeachment was inappropriate is we were impeaching a guy when he was already out of office and already removed. He couldn't possibly do the trial. And by the way, we stripped all the normal protections of any president and any impeachment would get so they could rush fast through it because they'd already made up their mind about what the appropriate outcome was. I thought at the time that if he committed a crime, the appropriate thing was to charge him with a crime and proceed that way in the courts. That wasn't done for a long time. And so, again, without casting aspersions on anybody, there's enough out there to – why did you wait so long? Was it because you thought he was politically dead in that time frame? But now you see he's not. And so we're going to use the Justice Department. And why is Trump charged on a documents case while Biden is not? Look, it's just at the minimum, because I can't read Modi's. It looks pretty bad. It looks like you have a double standard at the Justice Department and DOJ. And if you don't think millions of people believe that, then you're not paying much attention. So I think I have questions about some of these things that I would have never dreamed I would have had 10 years ago, 5 years ago, but I do now. And I think
the weaponization of the Justice Department.
Gosh, I can't believe I keep going blank, but let's look in 2017 at what the FBI was doing on the Russia case or what the FBI director was doing. I think it's outrageous, some of the things that happened. Or the Democrat, a Democratic campaign that systematically planted a story that they honestly knew was not true, in my view. And that most Democrats, I've seen the polling on it, like 78% of the last poll I saw, but to be fair, that's some time ago. But the Russians helped Donald Trump become president in 2016. I don't think that is remotely creditable. But that story, you had to figure out how you lost the election, I guess. And that became the explanation. So, again, the question to me ought to go to Merrick Garland, but I would say this. I think the actions and the delay and the manner in which this has proceeded and the fact that you have seemed to have one set of things that you're willing to charge one president for that you're not willing to charge another one. Look, I've read enough classified stuff. If you got it from the time you were in the Senate, what in the hell did you do? Walk out in a skiff with classified stuff and have it for years? And as vice president, you're not supposed to be reading that stuff.
You think they should have charged him?
I'm saying the charges should have been the same. They can decide which one. No, don't give me the cooperation. That matters in
sentencing. But doesn't the scale of the...
No. Yeah. Well, the scale's not all that much different.
You think so?
Yeah, I do think so, given the number of documents they found and the dispersion of them and the amount of time. But that aside, forget that. I do think if you're going to do it to one, you should do it to both. Or don't do it to either. But don't pick one and then not the other and think the question isn't going to come up. And I don't find the explanations I've heard particularly satisfactory. I could be fine with me if you want to do them both. And that, by the way, would impact politics the same way. Or you don't want to do either of them. And that would pack. But it leads to the question, is somebody putting their thumb on the scale here? Is somebody misusing? And my experience historically, I thought prosecutors leaned over backwards not to do stuff. But I've seen the FBI do things with the late Senator Ted Stevenson. They had to apologize for just why. I've watched this happen to my colleague John Doolittle. I've watched it happen to Pennsylvania Vice Chairman of Defense. Come back to me in a minute. But again, they're just
some people point former governor of Virginia.
Yeah. And I'm now I always tell people I don't see necessarily Democrat Republican bias in this. What I see is, boy, do they like to nail politicians if they can get them. And fair enough. But FBI searches 3 weeks in front of an election in somebody's home. I've seen that kind of stuff happen. So I would just say there needs to be some deep reexamination at DOJ and inside the FBI, because some of the things they've done have cost them the trust and credibility of the American people. And that's a very, that's a dangerous thing for them to lose. And again, this isn't new in the FBI. I mean, it's got a long history of having done things in the Hoover era and whatever that were beyond the pale. So I guess I'm just more skeptical about the justice system than historically I was. And I regret that. I wish I did not feel that way, quite frankly.
All right, final thing. Give us a question.
I wish I had one. I was filibustering there trying to
I could tell.
Think of a question. For the next guest. I don't know who it is, but I'm assuming it's going to be somebody political.
Yeah, that's probably the safest assumption is the category.
The category, yeah. I don't think you're probably going to be talking to a priest next.
If they do something interesting politically, but otherwise, no.
Well, a lot of it depends.
It can be philosophical. No. It doesn't have to be on the news. It could be anything you want.
Yeah, no, I wasn't going to make it on the news. The most interesting question to me that I ask almost every politician is, what got you in the business? Why did you? I didn't start my life wanting to be a politician. I'm always fascinated by the ones who do, but most of them didn't. Most of them, stumbled into this another way. So, what crossroads did you reach that you decided political life, whether it's elected or staff or whatever, it was the way you were going to go when there are so many other attractive alternatives? And then what kept you doing it? Why did you get involved the first time, and why are you still doing it, for God's sake? But reasonable people are leaving left and right.
Good. I like that. That's a good one. I thought you were going to ask what their favorite cigar is, but that might not apply to as many.
I know.
What do you smoke these days?
Favorite cigar is always free. but after that, my go-to is an Ashton or Monte Cristo number 2. I love both those cigars. Yeah.
Is that what that is? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's actually always a mixture. I mean, we keep, I'm a big believer in open humidors and open bars because they bring people together. People say, I used to tell this to Boehner. I said, quit the cigarette stuff. I mean, that's an addiction. I mean, you're sitting there going, for 3 minutes or something. A cigar, you're going to sit down for 30 to 45 minutes. And if you're doing it with somebody, you're going to know them. You're going to talk. You're going to have a relationship. You're going to find something in common with one another. It's just it's a lovely way to build a relationship and to socialize with people in a way that a cigarette generally isn't. And you never see a 15-year-old kid standing outside a building with a $20 premium cigar sucking it up. They don't do that. So this is an adult product, leads to adult conversations, and can quite often lead to some really interesting relationships, and frankly, good relationships between people that don't often get along. Last point, I mean, one of the worst things Pelosi ever did, and I know she did it for health reasons, but you guys won't
like
this.
I know where this is going.
Yeah, I mean, when you quit smoking in the speaker's lobby and when you let in the press, you just destroy one of the places where bipartisan relationships are built. That's how I got to know Barney Frank. That's how I got to know Jesse Jackson Jr. when he was up here. And, sit down, have a cigar, build a relationship. They were smoking cigarettes. And in Frank's case, I don't think he was ever a big cigar guy, but Jesse was. But anyway, I mean, there's got to be some spaces where people can get together. And it's not, we used to do this in rules office, one of the best smoking venues in the Capitol. But you'd get members from different generations there. I mean, Hal Rogers is there, to freshmen are there, different committees, and most people live their life within their committee. I don't know what the hell's going over in, you know, Ways and Means or ENC until they produce a product and head it toward the floor. But it's really interesting when you sit down, this is what we're doing in science, or this is what we're doing in ag, or, you know, this is why we have ag crop insurance or whatever. If you're not in those committees, you don't know. But again, over a cigar, people talk about their work, and even their questions are interesting. Their observations are interesting. So it's an enjoyable thing, but it's also a great way to learn information, build relationships, and frankly, in some ways, educate people. Because a lot of them, most people learn politics by listening to stories. You know, they're not going reading political science book, for God's sake. They talk to real politicians and they hear real stories, and that's interesting. So
bring back cigar diplomacy. That's the headline.
I tell you what, the world was a better place, I'm sure.
Thank you for doing this. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And that's our show. Our producer is Kara Tabor. Our senior producer is Alex Keeney. I'm Ryan Lizza, host and executive producer of Deep Dive. Our music is by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Tell us what you think about the show or who you'd like to hear on Deep Dive. You can email me at rlizza@politico.com. And please subscribe to Playbook Deep Dive wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.